It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. Today, it's the lunchbox and the question facing every parent in America. How do you get healthy food in there that the kids will actually eat? Well, answers come from a mom and distinguished nutrition authority, Marion Nessel. Her book is What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy food choices and good eating. The Stearns are at a Hungarian feast at Al's Corner Restaurant in Barberton, Ohio. Wine maverick Josh Wesson goes after those much-maligned pink beauties, rosés. We talk grilling Vietnamese style with Chef Mai Pham. And then it's an adolescent epiphany. One failing high school kid, one push cart, and one summer of selling egg creams on the streets of New York. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Thank you.
Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Today, nutritionist Marion Nessel tackles parents' most vexing issue, the school lunchbox. She's the author of What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy food choices and good eating. Our wine man of the independent turn of mind, Josh Wesson, says it's okay to drink pink. Rosés are finally getting their due. It's time to refocus our grilling. Forget the Southwest. Think East for fast food Vietnamese style. Novelist Tom Beller remembers himself as a confused 17-year-old, expelled from high school and trying to figure it all out with a pushcart on the streets of New York. Then we have the dinnerware that you can store in a file folder. And as always, in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can get to us at 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet Magazine. Jane, Michael, where has the automobile taken you recently?
Oh, we've been in Akron, Ohio.
Well, we actually were in Akron, but we went to Barberton, which is just outside Akron. And of course, serious food people think of Barberton as a place where they have these chicken wars, because there are four or five different restaurants that all specialize in a similarly cooked chicken dinner. But we went to Barberton for something completely different. Jane Snow of the Akron Beacon Journal took us to a place called Al's Corner Restaurant. It looks like almost nothing from the outside, just a kind of corner luncheonette with a glass wall. You walk inside. For one thing, it is neat as a pin. There's a U-shaped counter with all the chairs around the counter arranged exactly in order. You look to your right, and there is a steam table with home-cooked Hungarian food, the likes of which you will not find anywhere outside of some grandmother's home.
They had the best chicken paprikash with spetzel.
Should we just notice that the paprika for the paprikash is ground at Al's grocery just next door? Yes.
You're kidding.
And butcher shop. No, this is, everything is, I don't know, is there something beyond saying from scratch? I mean, pre-scratch.
They make their own sausages, they bake their own cakes, they cook their bread.
The weird thing is Michael and I ate a ton of delicious food, and the tab was $6.
What?
Each,
are you kidding?
Each of
yeah,
us.
For each
no,
of us.
No, the lunch special is $6.
Now, wait. First of all, is this like one Hungarian family? Is there a Hungarian
yes.
community there?
Yes, very, very big.
There is a Hungarian community
and
there.
And Slavic. Those are the two ethnic groups.
Uh-huh. Okay, there. Okay.
But Beth Gray and her husband own this place. They also own Al's Butcher Shop three doors down. The interesting thing is that Al's Corner Restaurant, which is open only for lunch, only Monday through Friday, doesn't even have a telephone. If you want to get in touch with the restaurant, you call the butcher shop.
Very commercial setup, obviously.
Yeah.
It kind of looks like an Edward Hopper painting. You know, there's something
so... But it's
so,
happier than that.
Yeah, it's not depressing like an Edward Hopper painting, but it has that very bare bones kind of clean-lined blue plate special look to it. And I have never seen such a clean restaurant in my life.
I'm still stuck on their grinding their own paprika.
And you know, it makes a difference. It's got a kind of a nutty, smoky quality to it. And, you know, I always buy Hungarian paprika at the store, and it's okay. But this is, you know, it's got a whole other feel to it.
What
and
a
taste
gem.
To it.
Hey, guys, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye.
Well, stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving. In the car, it makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Jane and Michael Stern are authors of Two for the Road. Now, you can hear the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, check out our free weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. Every week, we send you a new recipe designed to make your weeknight suppers a little easier. And we've also got a weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. Now, you're going to find it all and a lot more on the website, splendidtable.org. While the Stearns were in Ohio, I was hoofing it to New Mexico, to Santa Fe. We took a group on a music and food trip. And one of the best parts was touring the farmer's market with cookbook author Deborah Madison. It's 150 stalls of northern New Mexico specialties. For instance, one woman still dries her chicos in the old way. Now, chicos are dried sweet corn, and traditionally they're toasted in the horno, or horno, the local wood-fired oven that's shaped like a beehive. Well, the stuff you really want to bring home, in addition to the chicos, are things like red and green chili, bundles of sagebrush that you burn to purify the house, dried pozole corn, the rosemary jelly, and the wild apricot jam, and the Native American wild herb teas, and then there's local pine nuts and pistachios. Fall is a great time to go to Santa Fe. Just bring an extra suitcase. Wine Authority Joshua Wesson is a man devoted to the concept of equality in wine. He believes wine should be drunk every day and that bargains are to be had in every aisle. Josh, good to have you back.
Good to be here with you.
So what have you been up to?
I've been drinking a lot of pink wine. I hope you won't think the lesser of me.
You know, rosés have come into their own, but...
They really have. I mean, I think that pink is the new black. There's no doubt about it. You know, there's so many rosés being made all over the world. They've always been made in places where people make red wine. In fact, rosés were originally made to help the red wines become richer. They would bleed off a little bit of the juice as it was sitting in a tank to concentrate the red wine, and out would come pink wine, of course, if you bled the tank early in the fermentation process. And you end up with this pink wine. You bottle it because you don't want to throw it away.
Right.
And it's a halfway house of a wine. Rosés always will be partially made red wines. But as people began to taste and develop a fondness for this sort of second-hand wine, it moved to the front of the pack. And over the last 10 years, and absolutely in the last 5 years, a lot of very serious winemakers are devoting a fair amount of time and thought to making stylish, elegant, wonderful pink wines. And I love them for it.
I mean, it's really moved beyond the White Zinfandel and the blush, the sweeten it up and give it a pretty color and you can sell it at any bar in town kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, and the interesting thing is that most of the pink wine that's being made by these serious winemakers is being made in a dry style. And these are fantastic food wines, and they're fun to drink on their own, and they're pretty in pink. You know, there's just so many good reasons to give a new look at what was considered, you know, an old wine. Pink wine isn't just White Zinfandel, and it certainly isn't just sweet, and it's the better for both.
Yeah. So where are you looking these days for really excellent examples?
Well, you know, I don't have to look because the wines sort of wash over me from all over the wine world. Last week I tasted a wine from Australia made by Yolumba, very solid producer, the Y series. It's a limited release Sangiovese. Most people would think that rosés from Australia are probably going to be made from Cabernet or Merlot or Shiraz.
Right,
but this is a
right.
Sangiovese, and it is just a knockout of a wine. It tastes like fresh cherries with this beautiful roundness, a kiss of sweetness. I mean, one peck of three airbrushed, you know, kisses on a cheek. This is just a drive-by sweeting. And it's got beautiful acidity. It comes in a very nice bottle with a screw cap. Happy for that. Take it to a picnic or drink it, you know, with dinner. And it goes with about a kabillion different foods. And it won some big trophy in Australia recently. They have a lot of different trophies I've never heard of. This one was the Wine Society Perpetual Deliciousness Trophy. And it's just one for Sangiovese Rosé.
We have some friends we could give that award to.
Or not.
Or not.
You know, I like that wine line. It's about $10, $11. Great little wine.
Another one.
Well, you know, France is sort of given credit for inventing rosé down in Provence.
Right.
They still make a ton of delicious rosés from that part of the world. The Côte de Provence is arguably one of the best subregions in Provence to look for rosé. And I always go to this wine every year. It's sort of my old reliable friend, Domaine Sorin, S-O-R-I-N, Côte de Provence rosé, sells for about $10, $12. And it's rich and full of flavor. And if you closed your eyes, mm-hmm. it's one of those pink wines that you could almost convince yourself is a red wine. It's that serious. It's made from Grenache and Syrah and Mourvèdre and Cinsault, and they vinified and aged in big vats. Never sees any wood. Almost all rosés never see wood. They get their flavor from the grapes. And it's like fresh wild strawberries with a little bit of herb and mint. Oh, it's just so good. I want some right now. Yeah, can't beat it, can't beat it.
What about the United States? Because we're seeing a lot of rosés being produced on the West Coast, all over, really.
You know, I mean, there are exciting rosés all over the country and certainly coming out of California. But I wasn't as impressed with the rosés out of California as I was when I did a tasting of Oregon rosés, especially wines made from Pinot Noir. And everybody knows that Oregon makes fabulous Pinot Noir. But a lot of the winemakers up there are giving serious thought to making what they call Vingris or pink wines made from Pinot Noir. And these wines are delicious. And in some ways, they're even more food-friendly than the red Pinot Noirs that they owe their heritage to, because they've got a little more lick of acidity, and of course they can be chilled, and they're more palate-cleansing and mouth-watering. And I tasted one from A to Z, very modestly priced Oregon Pinot Noir rosé for about $15 that just blew my mind. It was just so good. I should say something about all the rosés that we've talked about.
Yeah.
If you're out there shopping for them, you got to find the freshest ones possible, which means 2005. That's the vintage to look for. If you find 2004, that's okay. But know that 2005 is going to be better, because with rosés, age is not a good thing. Time is not on your side. So get the youngest possible and try one. I think that that no matter where it's coming from, if it's dry and made by a real winemaker, it's going to be fun.
Sounds great. Hey, Josh, thanks.
Oh, my pleasure.
Joshua Wesson is co-creator of Bestsellers Wine Shops. Now, you can find Josh's rosé picks on the website, splendidtable.org. Coming up, nutritionist Marion Nessel takes on the Lunchbox Challenge, grilling Vietnamese style, and a teen's egg cream summer. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by SuperTarget, a grocery store and Target all in one, where guests can have their cake and a plate to eat it on, too. Online at Target.com/SuperTarget. Lunchbox season is back, and with the return to school, parents across America return to the familiar battlefield. What can we put in that box that's good for our kids and that they won't trade for a Powerade and a box of Lunchables? Well, Dr. Marion Nestle has some answers. She's been examining America's food systems through several books and years of research. Marion is former head of New York University's Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. She's worked with the FDA and the USDA. Now, her latest book is What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy food choices and good eating. Marion, good to have you back.
Oh, glad to be here.
Now, you're a nutritionist and a mother, so I want you to dissect the typical lunchbox with me, okay? Because most parents are working, and getting lunch for one or more children together on a daily basis is time-consuming.
Yeah, I used to cry when my kids went off to school because I was out of relief out of how difficult it was to get them out of the house. So I have endless sympathy for what parents are going through. And what really troubles me about it is how deeply entrenched marketers are in trying to get kids to think that some products are good for them and that that's what they're supposed to be eating in school lunches. So that parents are not only having the usual problems of getting kids to eat more healthfully, but they're also fighting an enormous marketing system that is set up to get the kids to think that they're supposed to have their own kinds of food and not eat what's in the lunch pail.
Well, let's break down that lunchbox. Lunch meat is kind of standard for people, and a lot of people think that if it says nitrate-free, if it says low-fat, all of
that. If it says organic.
Yes, if it says organic. Does that make that lunch meat okay?
It's still going to be salty and fatty. And I think it raises the question of what you put in a sandwich raises the whole question of what kids ought to be eating. Kids ought to be eating what adults eat. And adults ought to be eating healthfully. So if adults are eating healthfully, kids should be eating adult food. They don't need foods made just for them. And you want to train them as early as possible to like adult foods, the full range of textures, flavors, shapes, sizes, and colors, and get them to be adventurous eaters as early as possible. So what you want in a lunch sandwich is a really good bread, preferably one made with whole grains,
then
something in the bread that provides maybe some vegetables and certainly some protein. So the protein source can be meat, it can be cheese, it can be peanut butter, it can be any of those kinds of things. And you want it to be as low in fat and as salt-free as possible. So the taste of the food itself comes through, and the kids learn to like that. And you can teach kids to like these kinds of things, especially if they get to help choose and to have some participation in getting their own lunches together.
Okay, fruit snacks.
Oh, those aren't fruit. They're fruit-flavored candy. And it's one of the things about food marketing that troubles me the most, because those products, if you look at the labels, have fruit written all over them, and they have pictures of fruit and cartoons of fruit. And anybody who isn't reading the label carefully would immediately think that they were giving their kids fruit when, in fact, they're giving them sugar candy. Sugars comprise usually 50 to 90% of the calories in those products, and I think they should be put in the candy section, not in the kids' lunch section. I think you can use real fruit. Kids like bananas if they're reasonably ripe, and you can take an apple and cut it into pieces and throw in a little lemon juice to keep it from turning brown, and that works well.
Okay. The drink. Now, I think this is a big bone of contention, because you have these sports drinks, and I don't think they're very healthy.
Well, what everybody needs to understand is that most of these drinks are sugar water, and that even juices have a lot of sugar. I've just seen some 4-ounce little packages of juices, and I think those are a great innovation. That's about the right amount that kids should be having if they're going to be having juices, because they're very sweet. I think the object of the game is to try to encourage kids to drink water, or water with a little fruit juice mixed in with it. But mostly water. If they're thirsty, they should be drinking that. You don't want them drinking soft drinks, you don't want them drinking juice drinks, and you don't want them drinking tremendous amounts of juice, because that's going to add a huge number of calories from sugars.
What about the salty snacks and the sweets? I mean, the kids love both of those, and that's sort of the big treat in the lunchbox.
Well, I think a treat in a lunchbox is not a bad thing to do, but it should be a treat, an afterthought, a small proportion of the calories, not a large proportion. You know, cookies come so big now that they're 400 or 500 calories a piece. You don't want to use those.
They're dinner plates, yeah.
They're dinner plates. You know, you want to have some sense about it. You want the kids to be eating something that they like. You want something that's got some nutritional value in it. If you're going to give them cookies, give them oatmeal cookies with raisins in them. At least they'll be getting some fruit and some grains. whole grain if possible, and try to sneak it in whatever way you can, cut up and present it in a way that the kids can handle. And if the food tastes good, then the kids are going to want to hang on to it and aren't going to want to trade it for the kinds of packaged foods that come in Lunchables and other kinds of things like that.
Marion, thank you.
My pleasure.
Nutritionist Marion Nessel is former head of New York University's Department of Nutrition, Food Studies, and Public Health. Her latest book, which should be on everybody's research shelf, is What to Eat, an aisle-by-aisle guide to savvy food choices and good eating. America's lexicon of basic cooking techniques used to be the trusty old trio: boiling, roasting, frying. Now grilling tops the list, and we don't put the grill away in September. We grill all year, outside and inside. Now, personally, I'm a pushover for Asian grills, especially Vietnamese. Nothing tastes fresher. And some of my favorite ideas come from Southeast Asian authority and chef Mai Pham. She's author of The Pleasures of the Vietnamese Table. Mai, good to have you back.
Thank you for having me here, Lynn.
So, Mai, how does grilling figure into the cuisines of, let's say, Vietnam and Thailand? Is this something you do at home? Is it street food? Is it only in restaurants?
It's all of the above. We love grilling, and it really fits into the Vietnamese and Thai cuisines in a very big way. We grill, you know, all the time. Obviously, there's only one season in Asia, and it's hot most of the time.
Right, exactly.
And so grilling is a real easy way. It's very fast in Vietnam and in Thailand. I think the image that one could have of Vietnamese and Thai grilling, to kind of make it really simple, is that unlike maybe in this country where we grill a big piece of steak or a piece of chicken or, you know, a 7-ounce piece of fish, in Vietnam and in Thailand, the meat is sliced thin, and so it takes to marinate very quickly, and then we put it over a grill, and it could be any kind of grill. No fancy equipment is necessary
right,
in a Southeast
right.
Asian kitchen.
And with that little piece of meat, you're not using a lot of fuel either.
That's right. Fuel's expensive, so you can't be taking, you know, an hour to prepare any dish. And so meat is sliced really thin, marinated for less than 30 minutes, and then thrown in the grill and cooked in minutes.
Is there sort of a code to this? I mean, is it that you usually have a sauce, you usually have fresh herbs on the side, you usually have a marinade based on, you know, three or four ingredients?
Yes, there is. And let's talk about maybe Vietnamese first.
Okay.
The typical aromatics that you would use in a marinade would be lemongrass, of course, some garlic and some shallots. And I'll let you in on a little secret of the Vietnamese kitchen.
Yeah.
And that is, you use a little bit, like if you're using, let's say, a pound of meat, you would use maybe a teaspoon of caramel sauce. And when I say caramel sauce, it's just simply burnt sugar. And it's the secret of the Vietnamese barbecue. It gives it a little bit of a nice color, and because it's kind of like burnt sugar, and so it on the grill, it just becomes smoky in such a way that it's not so intrusive,
uh-huh.
but it's got a really light smokiness and a beautiful color. And so that is the basis of the Vietnamese marinade. And if you use this on chicken or on shrimp or on pork, it's lovely with pork. Anyway, you grill this and you would serve it with either noodles, rice noodles or rice, and with, you know, all the wonderful Vietnamese fresh herbs like the green perilla, like rau rum, which is Vietnamese coriander, or purple perilla. And, you know, all kinds of Asian basil, and you shred them up and you put them in the bowl with these rice noodles, and you drizzle a little bit of the Vietnamese nuoc chum, which is the Vietnamese dipping sauce.
Oh, that's the fish sauce and
the sugar and
lime in it, right?
Lime juice and garlic, yeah, and it's not fishy at all. It's wonderful. It's like a really light dressing. And so when you eat this bowl, you get everything, and that's the beauty of the Vietnamese cuisine, that it has this layering effect.
What about Thai? Is that sort of an offshoot? Can we use what you've just described as a foundation and then tell us what slight changes you might
make? Yeah, absolutely. You know, Vietnamese and Thai cuisine are similar in that they share similar ingredients, but the beauty of it is that the palate is different and the execution is different. The Thais would use, like in the grilled chicken, in which you serve it with sticky rice, you can have similar ingredients, but they would add some turmeric to it. They add more chilies and a little bit of coconut milk, just to give it a little bit of a richness. You know, it's the flavors in Thai cuisine is very accentuated. It's kind of like music. You listen at a certain level, and then you go to Thailand, the levels push way up, you know, and therefore your body gets really excited because everything is so accentuated.
Mai, thank you. Great ideas for grilling. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Lynn. Thanks for having me.
Mai Pham is chef owner of the Lemongrass Restaurant in Sacramento, California, and she's author of Pleasures of the Vietnamese Table. You know, some people walk through life instinctively. They know where they fit. They're at home with themselves. And then there are others of us who spend a lot of time groping, uncertain if there's any fit at all. Well, novelist Tom Beller tells the story of a misfit 17-year-old and an egg cream summer that introduced him to himself.
In the spring of 1982, I was expelled from high school. They didn't throw me out in the middle of my junior year, but in the superficially genteel manner characteristic of the place, informed me that I would not be, quote, invited back for senior year, as though school were some sort of a private party. For years, I had been a total catastrophe at that school, but in the last few months, I had tried, with some success, to shape up. So this setback was hard to take. And so it was one Sunday afternoon, while I was sitting at a long table in the mid-Manhattan library with a bunch of books and blank index cards trying to research a term paper, my attention wandered to the newspaper that someone had left. There I found a curious advertisement for a street vending company. I called the New York City Egg Cream Company. The owner of the company told me it was a great business. "Then why are you selling it?" I asked. The problem, he said, was that he had built more carts than he had room for on the two trucks that shuttled them into Midtown and downtown every morning. Sensing that his desperation was obscuring the fact he was talking to a high school student, I asked some more questions. He never caught on. In the end, I had to tactfully explain that I didn't have the resources, but was interested in taking one of his unused carts off his hands. As for the owner himself, I have only the dimmest memory, but Bill, his foreman, assistant, and chief operating officer, I can still see today. He was a huge man with big eyes and lanky arms, all topped by a white cowboy hat. It was Bill, the cowboy, who instructed me on how to make an egg cream. You put an inch of milk at the bottom, add two squirts of syrup, and then run seltzer water in, but not straight in. You put a spoon in there and turn it so the seltzer falls on its back. I don't know why this is the rule, but Bill, the egg cream cowboy, had made a big deal about the spoon part and about the brisk little stir at the end, and it seemed to work. Every morning, I pushed my cart from the garage where I leased space on 55th Street and 7th Avenue down to 47th Street between 6th and 7th, where I met Bill and the truck. That first morning, I was electric. "Egg creams," I shouted. "Get your egg creams here." In less than 15 minutes, I had made my initial sale. It was a happy moment, but it didn't really lessen my anxiety. I sold another one, and still I was screaming my head off about egg creams. The hot dog man on the corner eyed me wearily. I sold a chocolate. I sold a vanilla. I built up a wad of cash, and still every sale seemed certain to be my last. It was a feeling that never really left me the whole summer. I sold and sold. I had a spot in front of the ABC building. All sorts of interesting people went in and out of that building. Arthur Ashe bought an egg cream. Howard Cosell came down the steps and paused in front of my cart, amused and a little incredulous. I offered him an egg cream for free. At some point in the egg cream summer, I had the shopkeeper's epiphany that it takes about 3 or 4 days of selling to make the cash you need to meet your expenses. It was usually on a Thursday that I collected the dollar bill that earned me back my expenses for the week. And then there was a predicament. You could work the rest of Thursday and Friday and make a little profit. Or you could work Saturday as well and make more. You could work Sunday too. You could work nights and I did. That a business involving cash and conducted on the sidewalks of Manhattan might involve some violence should probably not have come as a surprise. 54th and 6th was a pastoral little spot, the pecking order well understood. The hot dog guy had prime position. I was number 2, then the Lebanese guy, and then the Chipwich guy, who were a little further down. But one day it rained all morning. Rain was a killer. Business was so terrible at the ABC building that I headed over to the spot I'd been occupying on weekends at 52nd and 5th. 4 carts were lined up along a corner that on weekends was totally empty. At the head of the line was a hot dog guy whose name was George. I suspect I learned this later, though I don't remember. Across the street was a guy named Nicky who did huge business with fresh-squeezed orange juice. Nicky and George were cousins, and so when a couple of young thugs came up to me that afternoon, announced they were George's sons, and told me they didn't want me selling egg creams on their corner, I knew that by there, they not only meant George's, but also some larger, more tacit family, a family for whom street cart vending wasn't just a summer job. My response to this command was similar to all my responses to commands at that time in my life. I tried to talk my way out of it. After a few minutes, one of the guys popped me in the mouth. I tasted blood. Showing my true character, I burst into tears. The puncher vanished into the crowd on Fifth Avenue. One of the other two vanished as well. One guy stayed behind, though, and tried to calm me down. He handed me some napkins from the side of my cart. Whether he was genuinely trying to console me out of human sympathy, or whether he was trying to talk me down because having a kid with blood pouring out of his mouth while sobbing his head off was even worse for George's hot dog and soda stand than having that same kid selling egg creams, I do not know. By the middle of August, I had saved a fair amount of cash and had decided to invest. I went in with a friend on some stock options. He was working as a runner on the commodities exchange for Bear Stearns, and he had a pass that could get us in through the front door of the New York Stock Exchange, though not onto the floor itself. We bought contracts that were about to expire and so were very cheap. We were gambling on a sharp price jump. The market was moving laterally in the low 700s. A week went by. Our contract was moving towards expiration, a total loss. By then, I was scaling back my egg cream operations a bit, so I made a plan to go down to Wall Street to look at the ticker one Friday afternoon. Above the doors, the numbers running past on the ticker were astounding, almost impossible to fathom. They were way up. Something bizarre was happening to the stock market. By the time the bell rang, the Dow had jumped 20 points. Our options were worth about 20 times what we had paid for them. My friend and I rode our gains to the low 800s, at which point I decided the market was overpriced. Not only did I sell, I placed another bet against the market. And the sector I decided was overvalued in 1982? Computers. A few weeks later, my egg cream savings had vanished into thin air. But the experience wasn't a total loss. The headmaster of the high school that had accepted me, Stanley Bosworth, was a highly eccentric figure toward whom my mother and I had a near worshipful attitude, not only because he let me into his school, but because he regarded me not as a colossal screw-up. He seemed to know who I was in reality. In fact, he had a better handle on it than I did, which I discovered when he sat down to help me with my college admissions essay. I was in the other side of his desk when, after a few minutes of conversation, he wheeled around in his chair and burst forth with an alarmingly cacophonous attack on his manual typewriter. When it was over, there was a page of writing about getting thrown out of school and starting my egg cream business and how I do things in an unusual way, but it's my way and it often has interesting results. I was in total shock. Not only had he resolved the conundrum of what to say in my essay by writing it for me, he had explained me to myself. And that, ultimately, was the great coup of my egg cream summer.
Novelist Tom Beller's story, The Birth of a Salesman, appeared in the August 2006 supplement to Gourmet magazine. He's the author of How to Be a Man, Scenes from a Protracted Boyhood. Well, it's time for this week's trivia challenge. Now, here's the question. When Napoleon was crowned Emperor of France, why did he choose the tiny, fragile bee as the symbol of his power? Well, we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle, online at target.com/supertarget. Now, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, when Napoleon was crowned Emperor of France, why did he choose the tiny, fragile bee as his symbol of power? Well, the bee symbolized immortality and resurrection. Golden bees were the emblems of the oldest rulers of France. And Napoleon needed to link his new dynasty to that ancient royal anchor. Now, he was the commoner who made himself emperor. He needed all the royal connections he could get. Now, I think there's another piece to the story, though. You see, Napoleon invaded Egypt. His dream was that the French make ancient Egypt their own. I mean, French furniture became Egyptian, hairstyles and dresses came straight from the hieroglyphics. And Napoleon's explorers discovered that the bee was on the crown of the kings of Lower Egypt. And the bee represented absolute omnipotence and all-knowing power. Exactly what a brilliant upstart from Corsica needed. It's time for your calls, brought to you by Hefty OneZip. Well, pick up that phone, guys. Give us a call. The number's 800-537-5252. Let's see. We have April calling from Columbus, Ohio. Hey, April, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Well, I'm a member of a community-supported agriculture group, and we get a lot of fresh kale every week.
Right.
And it's great. But we get a lot of fresh kale every week.
And it's sort of, oh, my God, more fresh kale this week.
Yeah, and it's great because it's fresh and it's organic, so I'm very excited to have it. But on the other hand, I feel like I'm not doing it justice because I don't really know what to do with it. I mean, right now I'm just surrogated for spinach in any recipe I can find.
And well, that's a good way to go. I mean, it can work that way. Is it very young kale? Are the stalks very narrow?
Most of them are. We get a couple every once in a while where the stalks will be a bit thicker.
Uh-huh. Okay. Kale that has stalks that's less than a quarter inch thick, that you can just sauté. But kale, as it gets more mature, you want to sort of pre-steam it first or drop it in boiling water or wilt it just to get rid of some of the oxalic acid, which is that sort of bitter undertaste that it can have.
Yeah.
And you get rid of that by essentially dropping it in water, boil it for 1 minute, or cover it with boiling water and let it stand for 3 or 4 minutes and drain it. And then you can do anything you want with it. But you know, one of the things that occurs to me, especially with the young leaves, you could drop them in boiling water to wilt them, take out the thick stem. But what you could do is you could take small pieces of seafood that maybe you've marinated, you know, in a teriyaki mix or something like that, that has a little sweetness to it.
Yeah.
Wrap the kale around it and grill it. Brush it with oil and put it on the grill. And what's going to happen is that the kale is almost going to char. It'll get very close to that. It'll brown a bit, and it'll have a really great taste. I mean, you could do it also with chicken breast. Anything that's sort of thin and cooks relatively quickly. The other thing is there are some of the classics that you do with kale. I mean, kale with beans, especially chickpeas.
Mm.
You do a sauté with chickpeas and raisins and pine nuts and a lot of garlic and onion, and then you can toss that with penne pasta.
Oh, that does sound good.
Yeah, I mean, that nothing is bad about that.
And that, you know, I just hadn't even thought to play it against a sweet.
Yeah, I mean, it kind of works well that way.
Yeah, that would make it, because I guess that's why I called. I don't want to be bored with my kale. It seems like it should be exciting.
It can be. And the other place to think about pairing it is with hot chilies.
Oh.
Because, again, it has a real robust quality to it. And that robust quality is going to mean that it's going to stand up to the heat of chilies. So, you know, think of Mexico, think of Italy, think of the Mediterranean.
Oh, you know,
go to Japan, go to China.
good. Diversity has come back to me.
Exactly.
Thank you very much.
You take care.
All righty.
Bye.
Bye.
This is great because the community-supported agriculture, what I love about it is you never know what's coming. And you just have to fly with it. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Let's see, who do we have up next? We have Joan calling from Santa Cruz. Joan, what do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fresh red currants. I was at the farmer's market over the weekend, and I like to try new things, and they had little baskets of fresh red currants. And the people that I were talking to there, they're all going to make scones or cake or something. But I would love to put that those maybe in a chutney of some sort.
Ooh, yeah, yeah. Red currants look like little pearls of ruby, don't they?
Yes.
One way that they're used is they're used in savory dishes as a sauce for sautés. So especially things that are bolder like pork or beef or lamb, where you might brown the lamb chop for argument's sake, or, you know, the pork chop or that kind of thing in a pan, and then you'd throw in the red currants and you'd throw in a little bit of vinegar and some sugar. And you'd almost caramelize them. And that makes a wonderful, almost like a glaze over meats or fish. That combination is fabulous with salmon, by the way.
Oh, with salmon.
Yeah,
wow.
Yeah. And the other thing you could do is you could take the currants, grill your salmon over on the grill, but make a sauce ahead where you take the currants with vinegar and sugar and maybe some garlic and salt and pepper, and you boil that until it's like a thick chutney, and then you put that on the salmon.
Great.
Which is not a bad thing at all. And you could also put that in the refrigerator, and that's your chutney that you can be serving with many things. Spread that on bread with a ham sandwich.
And,
yeah. And also, by the way, roasted peppers, you know, roasted on the grill.
Yeah.
Just skin them, put a little bit of that chutney into the center of the pepper, and just serve it. Or put a little bit of goat cheese on top of that, fresh goat cheese.
Oh, wonderful.
Enjoy it.
Thank you.
So,
love your show.
I'm envious. Hey, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Fresh red currants. They're classic, by the way, with game. You can reach us, 800-537-5252. We have Herb calling from Minneapolis. Herb, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I am calling about freezing herbs. In the summertime, I tend to buy them in bunches, and I can never use up all that I buy.
You're in such good company.
Specifically cilantro. One thought I had, could I make pesto with it, and can I freeze that?
You know, I've never tried it, but it makes sense. You know, one of the things that people do with something like cilantro, because cilantro is one of those herbs that freezes. Most green herbs freeze and they get very dark, but they keep their flavor.
Okay.
But one of the things you might want to think about doing with cilantro is pureeing it and freezing it. And some people actually make cilantro ice cubes. In some words, you puree it with a little bit of water, and then you pour it into ice cube trays. And once it's frozen, you can pop it out, and you've got a tablespoon of cilantro.
Okay, great.
Yeah, just give that a shot. There is one trick I've realized for keeping the herbs in the refrigerator in good shape, and that is when you get them home, release them. Don't leave them in the bunch with the rubber band.
Right.
Okay, open them up because you want air to get to them. And if there's any moisture, just roll them loosely in paper towel, put them in a heavy bag, you know, that has a sealed closure, press all the air out of it and put them in the fridge. And they'll keep in really great condition for a week or more that way.
Okay.
Hey, you take care.
All right, thanks, Lynn.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
You can reach us, 800-537-5252. And remember, you know, almost every herb freezes well. It's the time of year because they're not going to get better and they're certainly not going to get cheaper. And when I think about spending, what, $2.99 for four sprigs of something, get to the farmer's market. You can call us, 800-537-5252. We have Quentin calling from Knoxville, Tennessee. Quentin, what do you want to talk about?
Thanks for having me on, first of all.
Oh, you're welcome.
Lynn.
You're welcome.
I would like to know what is the proper amount of time to cook corn on the cob on the grill.
Ooh. You know, that's kind of a very flexible response that comes with that.
No, yeah,
no, but
I figured it would
yeah,
be.
Yeah, you know, with Casper, it's never simple. this is the deal, okay? I like my corn warmed through. Okay, this is me, right? And my one of my now. So if you like your corn caramelized, right, you want to get it on. You want to get it. You know, you pull the husk back, okay, and you brush it with oil or butter and salt, and you put it in the very hot part of the grill, and you cook it until it starts to just pucker or maybe even brown a bit. But we're talking where it's hot as you know what, so it cooks fast, and. That's one way to approach it. But the way I like to do it is I pull back the husk, I wash it, right? And then I slather the whole thing with butter, and I put just a little salt, because I'm going to salt it later, and I put back the husk, and I tie it up at the end. And then I roast it slowly, until I see a little butter seeping out of the husk, and the husk starts to get, you know, kind of brown, right?
Yeah.
But inside, the corn is still sweet and very delicate. So maybe it's 4 or 5 minutes on a side, and then you pull back that husk, and it's saturated in sweet butter. And then you can salt it and pepper it and do whatever you want to it. So you choose. Do you want caramelized, a little leathery, but, you know, that kind of deep, lusty taste, or do you want corn that's just warmed through and it's oozing in butter?
I like your way of doing it a lot better. I'm a big fan of butter also, but
not to like, right? Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, exactly. So I think the latter is my preferred way.
Then
so
that's, try it. See, because it's a matter of how, also have the cobs at room temperature. And I would give it 3 to 5 minutes to a side. And what you can always do is just, you know, kind of peek and see, is it warm? Mm-hmm. Is it hot? Once that kernel is really hot, then you're done.
Okay.
But you're shielding it from the direct heat by doing with the thing. And see what happens. But I think this is what you're going to enjoy. And I can't give you an exact timing, but, you know, I'd say 3 to 5 minutes per side is about right.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah, and one final question.
Sure.
What kind of beer would you recommend for corn on the cob?
You know what? Because of the sweetness, a summer wheat beer.
Okay.
Yeah, because they tend to have a sweet quality to them.
Yeah.
And you serve them cool, and I think that would be a luscious way to do, because most beer is too dry for sweet corn. You know, it's bitter next to the sweet corn. You want a beer or some one of the sweeter ales. I don't mean a flavored beer, but, you know, some of the ales tend to have a lot of fruitiness to them. But I think a summer wheat beer, it's like corn. It's only here for a short time, and it's utterly delicious.
That's a great point, and that sounds excellent.
You want a spiritual marriage here, you know?
Exactly.
Hey, thank you, Quentin.
Thank you very much, Lynn.
You take care. Goodbye.
Yeah, have a good day.
You too. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Christopher Columbus may have had it all wrong. Flat can be better than round, especially if you camp, hike, picnic, or merely are shy of cupboard space. Flat is good, as in a flat cup or a flat bowl. Well, I'm talking about a company in England that makes a product called Oricasso, and its inventor is Jay Cousins. Jay is on the phone. Jay, welcome.
Hi, Lynn. How are you?
I am good. Now, Jay, flat cup. What are we talking about here? What is Oricasso?
Well, the reason we coined the phrase Oricasso, Lynn, is it means literally folding plastic. Like origami means folding paper.
Oh.
So we adapted origami-like principles to enable a flat sheet of material, if you can imagine that, that will turn into a mug with a handle on it, or a bowl that you can use for your soup or your cereal, or even a plate, which sounds fairly easy to do, a flat plate, but actually it was one of the harder products.
Why was it so hard?
Because the actual fold technique that I've developed and designed needs a tab mechanism, and the lower you make a height, the smaller the tab has to be, so it's maintaining that structural integrity, yet making it look like a plate at the same time.
Now, but I would imagine to make a plate that's stable, you'd have to have a pretty stiff material, and yet it has to be soft enough to fold. So what's the material?
The material we use is polypropylene, which is a remarkable material. It's environmentally friendly material. At least as far as the plastics go, and all of the materials fully recycled on site. But what makes polypropylene unique is the fact of its living hinge property. And its living hinge property means that on the crease, the more that you fold it on the crease, a normal plastic would degrade.
Right.
But polypropylene doesn't degrade. It actually strengthens along the crease the more that you fold it.
So you're saying that you can keep reusing these?
Yes.
This is an interesting idea. Now, let me see if I understand this. I can go hiking with a bunch of flat pieces of plastic, right?
Yeah.
I can make my dinnerware out of them, and then I can rinse them out, take them apart, and I come home with flat pieces of plastic.
That's correct. Although we actually recommend that you unfold them before you rinse them out, because then you can just wipe it clean on the grass. Much easier to clean as well.
Well, wiping clean on the grass is an important piece of information here. I think this is this is really great. How often can you reuse it?
We actually put a lifetime guarantee on the product, Lynn, because polypropylene is a highly durable material. We've tested ours up to sort of 4,000 to 6,000 repetitions. But polypropylene in industrial applications can be used a million folds upwards. So we're figuring within a lifetime's use of camping, you're not going to wear through these. They're pretty much indestructible.
I wonder, has NASA approached you yet? I mean, this is a natural for the space program where space is a problem.
they haven't approached us yet, Lynn, but if anybody from NASA's out there and wants to talk, then we'd be happy to have a chat with them.
So what's next for you, Jay?
Next, we're continuing to bring new and fresh products out onto the market. Obviously, we don't want to divulge too much, but we're currently releasing fold flat shot glasses and fold flat espresso cups into the marketplace as a promotional item and a promotional tool. But we're growing our customer base worldwide and the markets that we already operate in, because we've identified that a lot of people outside of the camping world can benefit from these products as well.
How long have you been doing this, Jay?
I've been doing it since May 2003, officially, although I first had the idea in May 2001 as part of my degree project.
So you got the idea while you were in college?
Yeah, that's correct.
Uh-huh. Well, we wish you good luck.
Thank you.
I love the colors. I'm going to get my hands on some of this. Dinner parties are never going to be the same at our house. Thanks a lot.
That's fantastic. I'm glad you like them.
Take care. Jay Cousins is inventor of Oricasso plates and founder of Flat World UK Limited. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for being with us. And remember, you can call us anytime. The number is 800-537-5252. And in honor of baseball season, let me leave you with this thought from former LA Dodgers manager Tommy Lasorda. He said, "When we lose, I eat. When we win, I eat, and I also eat when we're rained out." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Now, everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. And you can download our weekly podcast, Kitchen Questions. So sign up for both online, splendidtable.org. The Splendid Table is brought to you in part by Hefty, maker of the Hefty OneZip, a food storage bag designed so that the rest of the family can close it. Our producers are Sally Swift and Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lukey. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Jeff Harkness. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. And thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.